I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Midpoint. Today's episode is quite special because it marks the start of a new era for the podcast. I'm giving it a little makeover, if you will, freshening things up with a slightly new format. For months now, I've been interviewing our brilliant experts and wishing they had more than the 10 minutes they get to share all their knowledge with us. And since I've been getting a great reception to our expert-only episodes where you get to put the questions directly to them, I thought maybe we stick to one guest per episode, usually celebrities at the midpoint in life with lots of stories to share. But we're going to make sure we have our in-depth expert chats more often. Call it a midpoint pivot. And speaking of midpoint pivots, my celebrity guest today has been through one of the most extraordinary midlife transformations I've ever heard of. Comedian Laura Smith was standing at the front of a classroom teaching English 5 years ago, but today she's touring the country as a stand-up comedian. Her 2024 show is called Living My Best Life, and it's selling out fast. And that title is certainly multi-layered. Just a year after she'd made this bold career change, she was given a stage 3 cancer diagnosis. Laura was terrified she'd missed her chance to live her dream. But her illness gave her a new perspective and freed her from a lot of the self-doubt and fear that can hold us all back. And in 2022, just 2 weeks after finishing her cancer treatment, she fulfilled her dream of walking out on stage at Live at the Apollo. Laura has said she hopes everyone gets to a point where resisting feels more risky than surrendering to the fullness of life. And I can't wait to hear more about that. So please welcome Laura Smith. Laura Smith, thank you so much for coming on The Midpoint.
Oh, thanks for having me, Gabby. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you.
I've given a kind of bio of a bit of your incredible last few years in your introduction. And I saw you on the Apollo when it happened.
Yeah.
But I didn't know much of your backstory at the time. I just thought you were a very funny woman.
Yeah.
And in researching and getting ready for today, I obviously found out a lot more about what you have been through.
Yeah.
Should we take it one step at a time?
Yeah, cool, go for it. Let's get right in there, yeah.
You were a teacher, an English teacher. So tell me about why you thought you should give up teaching teenagers and get yourself on the stage and be funny.
Well, it's something I'd always wanted to do. People say, oh, when did you make the decision? I was obsessed with it. I always say my whole adult life, I'd write routines in my head. I love comedy. It's just that thing that I always say this, and I think surely every household was like this, but comedy was a big thing growing up. Sometimes I watch like reruns of Harry Enfield and Chums and not even realise that catchphrases from that, like from way back early 90s, are like in our family idiolect. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like we've obsessed with comedy. I just think of it, that was always
a
big
thing.
Are
you all funny?
All funny, competitively so. That's the only rule, I think, growing up was be funny.
How many siblings?
Well, there's six of us in total. My dad had two children from his first marriage, and then there's us four, who are all sort of pretty much 20 months apart, not even, the four of us. So we were all just really close. It was all just be funny. We just liked entertaining each other. So I think it was, it feels like inevitable that one of us would do it. And then it was when I was going back after my third child. I think that I was a single mum, so I did go back to uni after I'd had my eldest.
This can I just interrupt, because there was a lovely article I read about you where it said that was an old teacher stopped you in the street and said, basically, did you go to uni?
Well, yeah, I'd really lost my confidence after doing A-levels, and I'd bumped into my A-level English teacher, and I'd just had Rosie. She was about one and a half or something. And she said, oh, what are you doing? And I said, oh, bums, tums and thighs. We're at a leisure centre. And then she said, no, with life. And she said, well, why aren't you doing an English degree? She really sort of told me off about it. And, you know, I was on my own with her. I was in temporary accommodation. I had a housing officer, and my housing officer looked into how I could do my degree and sort of, you know, how I could do an access course and get back into it. And she really, there was lots of right women sent at the right time, you know. And I went back and I just loved it. And I just, it meant so much to me. And I really got my confidence back from doing it. And by the end, I so enjoyed writing. I thought, well, maybe I'll go into journalism. But there was a programme where I could spend a two-week placement in a school, which I did in Waltham Forest. And the classroom just, everything felt magic in the classroom and teaching. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So And it was great because, as you know, like when you've got kids, you want something that can work around the kids. So the thought of having holidays with my eldest and all that sort of stuff. So I absolutely love teaching, and it gave me so much confidence. And
you're performing every day.
You're performing every day to tough crowds, and you're adrenaline fueled, and it's just magic. And I just loved the fact that I sat at lunch every day with people with English degrees. So even if we were talking about, I don't know, you know, something on television, it was with a certain context, and you know,
you're critiquing all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the kids that you were teaching, did you see lots of you out there? Did you, you know, did you want to tap into kids who perhaps were not going to potentially go down the path, you know, that you eventually managed to find? Were you good at rescuing kids?
I was good at rescuing kids, because what I found, and maybe it's a working class thing, but I can only speak from that perspective, but I found that, like, this idea that if you hadn't succeeded by 18, things were sticky, and you had to do something, and everything was a bit of a failure. And I find that school can really let kids down when some kids just won't have it by 16 and they won't have it by 18. And I'm seeing it with my oldest as well. She kind of, you know, she did her A-levels during lockdown, so everything was a bit tough for her. And I've just let her take her time. And now she's gone back to university after a couple of years of working, and she's really thriving at university. And I thought I'd never see the day. Not that she's not clever and not academic, but just the sort of wherewithal you need and the organisational skills and all those sorts of things. So in terms of certain children that I taught, I really was there for them a lot, in that sense of I hated school, and I hated authority, and I hated the idea that, well, you listen to me just because. So I really did understand that they struggle with things, and I understood that if they weren't there at 9 o'clock but they're at 9:05, that was a big achievement sometimes. And, you know, I wasn't heavy with kids like that, so I really understood those children, and I understood those children that maybe didn't have an understanding of where they wanted to go in life and didn't maybe have a model of knowing what the next steps are. So,
and did they come to your classes because they knew that there would be at some point a killer gag, a good laugh, you'd find the funny?
Well, the thing that's funny, truth is funny, isn't it? And so that's all you need to tap into. So when you really understood the children, so sometimes you teach something like structure in English, and they wouldn't understand how to analyse structure. And I'd say, well, think about it like this. And they'd be like, you know, they're all 15 years old. So I said, imagine if you sent a long paragraph to a boy and he waited 4 hours to text back and he just wrote K cool. They're like, oh, I said, that's structure. and they'd always get that. So as long as you found, I think that's what's led into my comedy, that if you find an in with people, because really you're reading a room to see where they are and then what they'd understand, what they need, and then where to take them. So that's comedy.
And did your parenting go along the same lines as well? Have you parented through comedy?
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, I mean, if you haven't got humour, I think you'll struggle. And there are, we all know, like, you know, we were talking just beforehand about oppositional children or people...
Challenging kids
with strong opinions. Unless you diffuse that with humour, you can be like, sometimes you can have a tantrum, you hate me. I go, yeah. Yeah, you're right. And they go, what? And they're so taken out of themselves. There's often that's better than saying, oh, mummy doesn't hate you, darling, and pandering. You know, you can really sort of unseat someone and get them back on track like
so
that.
So we digress slightly from what was going on.
Yes.
So you're teaching.
Yes.
And eventually you meet your husband.
I did, yeah, yeah. Not long after I started teaching. So that all happened. And I think I gave the context of being a single parent in that, other than giving loads of context all the time. But because I think that was so aspirational to be like, I'm a teacher and now I'm married and now I have children. And then
you're ticking all those societal
boxes. Tick, tick, tick. And it was just like, oh, I don't want any of this. I don't care about any of this. I don't, you know, and both my husband and I were teaching then. And I thought, you know, we need a bigger boat. We've got more kids. We need a bigger house. And I thought, you know, even if we save for a bigger house and then we're sort of travelling on the A13 every day into our jobs and killing ourselves till our mortgage is paid off, we both sort of thought, well, we've got skills, to quote Napoleon Dynamite, we've got mad skills. Oh. So we thought we consciously said we want to roll the dice here and see. He's a musician. He was head of music at a college and he started recording an album and he gave up work and he's, you know, got his own company, Landscape Gardening, and working for ourselves and having that autonomy and just that feeling of like, well, what if I did go for my dream? And what I'd only admitted to my husband that I wanted to be a comedian. And he started telling people, oh, Laura's a teacher and a comedian, before I'd even done it.
Really?
So he'd done that. And I said, Charm, you can't find out.
And at that point, you weren't doing
nothing.
Anything?
No. But he...
Were you writing things?
No. I always just used to think of gags. My brother's one of the funniest people I know. I'll say one of, because my sisters go, how dare you? But my brother's really funny. And often we have conversations where he's observed something really funny. He goes, but there's a joke there, isn't there? And I'd always very quickly go, this is it, you know. And so we'd always be batting ideas off each other. He's a creative in another field. And so it was always something I wanted to do. And then for a wedding gift, my husband bought me a day's writing course with a comedian, and it was a group of people. So it was a nice gift. And it was
Was it worth it, do you think? That was obviously you've then gone on and you're a professional comedian, but was that day, if anybody's listening thinking, I really want to do this, would that be something you would recommend?
It was really worth it. It was in the same way I felt like I was with my people with English teachers. I really felt, oh, I'm with my people here. Mm-hmm. And the teacher said something that, because I'd had another child by then, and I was teaching, I was going back to work, and he said, oh yeah, I've never done a real day's work in my life. And that, you know, when you go, yeah, that's, I want that, I want to join the circus a little bit. And it took me a couple of years before I signed up to a full course. But yeah, it was that sense of, I know I want something more here. I think I'd established the foundation. The box ticking was a really nice foundation. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I want more.
Who are you looking at in the comedy world and thinking I could? Because it's not that long ago, women weren't even on panel shows, right?
No,
so
no,
were you
no.
looking at women who were making their way in the comedy world, or did you not have anybody that was kind of your mentor?
Not so much a mentor. I mean, it's that feeling of, I see myself in you. Like, I just adored Kerry Godleyman in her acting, and because she seemed so... It's always that feeling of, you know, Melissa McCarthy I love, mm-hmm. but she's Hollywood, you know. Mm-hmm. There's always that sort of things that seem unattainable. Somehow there's something about Kerry Godman where you go, you can imagine bumping into her. You can imagine sort of having a laugh with her in a cafe or a night out sort of thing. So all of a sudden that felt tangible. And then Catherine Ryan, I just loved Catherine Ryan. The minute I saw her on a few panel shows years ago, and then more and more of her, then more and more of her, and then... I just really followed her career because I just thought, wow, you're really unapologetic in where you stand in the world. And, you know, her book.
Is that the title of her memoir?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, and she was a single parent, and just she writes a good gag. She's funny.
So when did you say, right, no more teaching, it's all about the comedy from now on? What year was that?
I had such a huge trajectory the first year. I'd started in April 2019. 5 months later, I'd won the Funny Women. I was signed with United Agents. And so everything was going, go.
So 2019 was a great year.
Oh, went it was crazy. And then March...
What could possibly happen to slow stuff down? I can't imagine what you're going to say.
You know, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, where he says, do I dare disturb the universe? I was like, that's what I did. I disturbed the universe. You know, like, I kind of thought, oh, yeah. It really felt personal. And then I found out that everyone felt personal. It felt real personal. How? Hang on a minute, world. I was going for it.
Yeah.
But what that meant was, I mean, often when you're signed it quite early in your career, that they're quite happy to let you gig and see where things go. But because nothing else happened, I ended up having meetings with producers. And then I developed a treatment which got a script commission with the BBC really early March 2021, rather. We've had a year of lockdowns and in and out. And I sat in a meeting where we were being taught how to use a certain software so we can teach a lesson and project the lesson to kids back home. And everyone's asking these really earnest questions. And I just sat there and thought, I could not give a flying fig. This is not what I'm done. And I knew I was done. And I said, and I hadn't even got my script commission yet. And I thought, I think I'm done. And I just thought, whatever happens, if there's another, I have to accept that I'm done with this. Whatever
in the
happens
movie,
in comedy,
you kind of smash the table and walk out.
Yeah. I just sort of thought, I'm done. And then, so I handed in my notice in that March, so to see the year out, which was great. And I just felt very free from doing that and was ready to go, you know?
Mm. And then?
Then, September 2021... I was ready. I was ready to go. I'd got through teaching with my agent, and then I got through a pandemic, and everything was go, go, go. And I found a lump in my breast in September. Didn't go back to school, found a lump. I've watched enough Dr. Pimple Popper to think of nothing of it. I thought, that's probably a lipoma or a cyst. You know, I've known much. So, but then I even went to the doctor. Yeah, don't think it's anything, but go anyway. Went to the hospital. Don't think it's anything, go anyway. Sure enough, it's breast cancer. And so it just... Again, it floored me. It just floored me. And I remember saying to my sister, between the biopsy and the scans, I said to one of my sisters, and everyone was like, be positive, but it's a funny thing when they know it is that, because it's not, the sort of cavalry arrives straight away. You go, oh, they're not, I can tell they're treating this differently. And I said, you know, I said to my sister, I feel like I fought for everything in my life. I fought for my job. I fought for my flat. I fought for teaching, you know, I fought for my husband even. I fought for this. I said, if I've got cancer, I said, I ain't got any fight in me left. You know, I don't think I've got any fight in me. And I remember saying that. And even saying that, I can't even relate to the person that said those words because I feel so different from that. And I've talked a lot about like objecting to the idea of, you know, fight cancer.
Yeah. Mm.
Because it wasn't a fight. It was a kind of, oh, this is a lot. And I really lent into this idea that, okay, I think it's a mentality. I thought if the worst that can happen is that I'm going to die, I need to be cool with that. And I got cool with that. I thought I'm all right with that.
How quickly did you?
We're talking weeks because the anxiety was so acute. I was exhausting myself with those horrible letters that come through the door from the hospital that anyone that knows, or waiting for a scan or sitting on plastic chairs. I hated the car park. I hated the walk down the corridor. I hated the doctors, if I'm honest. I hated it all. It felt so disempowering because I'd really, in my career, tried to grab this sort of dream of feeling empowered and taking that autonomy back for myself. So I felt so resentful that I thought, I can't stay in this state. I cannot stay in this state. And I got the results sort of mid-October, and then it was half term and we went to Wales, I think. And I remember I was doing wild swimming then. It felt really like, okay, and I was still waiting to know what the treatment plan would be and when the surgery would be and what's going on. And I just said to my husband, tell me you and the kids will be all right if I die. And he's like, yeah, we'll be all right. And he was obviously not meaning that. But I said, all right, well, we can handle that then. We can handle that. And I thought, I remember Oprah said, if I could give one advice to of all the things is the gratitude list. And I now, again, I can't relate to this. It's just like in the same way you can't remember toothache. Mm. I remember forcing myself to do a 5-point gratitude list every morning. And now that felt like a rope getting me out of a really dark well of a pity party and just anxiety. And I had to get good. And a friend down the street, she's a yoga instructor, and she was doing an MS, something on restorative yoga or qualification. So she was looking for people to be case studies about restorative yoga for health. And I hadn't emailed her in time. She went, oh, but come for sessions. And I just was going to her house and I just rested in that. And then I bumped into a friend who was, who our dogs just get along. He's got a dog and our dogs get along. And he's a trained hypnotherapist. He says, oh, I'd like to give you hypnotherapy. It's like everything responded.
A bit like the women who came out to rescue you when you were in your 20s.
Yeah, exactly
you then
that.
Found,
because the healing.
You kind of became open to it.
I came open. It was like, I need healing here. And I know this, I hate speaking like this because it's not anybody's fault to get cancer. And I'd hate any language like that. Anyone can get it and it doesn't matter. You know, there's risk factors and all those sorts of things. But there felt like something inevitable about mine. I felt like I've internalised so much stress all my life. I've put so much on my shoulders. And I just felt everything felt quite heavy. And I thought, I just want a sort of uprooting of, if I die, I want to die feeling whole, as in not seeing someone else's expectations or trying to prove I'm a good girl from being a young singer or trying to be this. I want to get rid of all my shit. That's the only way I can describe it. All my sort of, it's funny, isn't it? We just carry so many hang-ups. And I thought, that's what I want to get rid of. For whether I live or die, that's what I want to get rid of. And I really just, I just did that. I had, like I said, my joke goes, I had restorative yoga, hypnotherapy, spiritual healer, cranial osteopathy, cancer turned me middle class. But it's true. I just totally rested. So it wasn't a fight. It was a love. It was, I'm sitting with myself and I'm really going to take care of myself. And I got very selfish, like so healthily selfish from being, you know, someone that put others first a lot. And it was magical to do that, to be able to be forced into that. And I said to my cranial osteopath recently, I was talking about someone, well, obviously it's not their fault. They haven't had the privilege of fighting for their life. She went, wow. I was unwittingly sort of really positive, but I thought, yeah, that is how I see it. I had the privilege of going, well, I've really got to go for this sort of thing. And then
from being in a position where you felt you had no fight.
No, yeah, exactly.
You turned that into something that was a completely different mindset,
yeah,
which is so empowering. You know, whatever was going to happen next,
yeah,
you were in a state where you could handle things.
Yeah.
I think that's what people who are fighting any kind of disease and having to go through, as you describe it so brilliantly, the car parks, the plastic chairs, the vending machines, all of that. And anybody who's going to hospital constantly to visit a relative, that's the stuff that is just grinding, isn't it? And depressing.
It is depressing. I mean, I lost my eldest sister to breast cancer, and my sister and I say, when you think about how I was going through the treatment and how she was going through a divorce, and it was messy. Her life was messy. Things were quite heavy for her. And then we say, she didn't stand a chance, did she? Mm. You know, and it's hard to talk in these terms because, of course, we have huge studies on Western medicine, and we know what chemotherapy does. We know what radiotherapy does, but there's also so much anecdote. You know, they can't do a controlled saying, you change your career, you don't change your career, see who does, or you leave your husband, you don't, or, you know, all these sorts of things. You can't really do a controlled test on those things, but we know stress is a huge impactor on your immune system and your ability to fight any illness, anything. So I was so stressed in my teaching role. It got more increasingly stressed. I was stressed having the children. I was sort of, it was a lot of pressure on and stress, and I just feel very, I can't relate to all of that stress. Mm. Sometimes people will say, you know, something like, oh, where are you on Friday? Or something like, I don't know, I'll deal with Friday on Friday. And that's so not, it was never me, you know.
So when you were in Wales and you started to change your mindset going forwards, and you were waiting for your plan, the plan arrives and you're then embarking on, you're in the medical kind of process, aren't you, as well as your healing process at the same time. And that's 2 years ago?
Yes, so 2.5 years ago, I had a mastectomy in November, just a few days before my 40th birthday, and they thought it was all contained, but it wasn't. They took a sample of lymph nodes, and then I had to have second surgery. So this is, it's all quite dark here, because then they had a second surgery to remove my, auxiliary lymph nodes. And then because it had been in the lymph nodes where they didn't think it was, I had to have full scans to see
where else
it could be. And that was the big changing point. And again, it was, that's where the big change was, because I was lying in bed crying, and to get my head together to sit on those plastic chairs after parking the car and after this, and potentially go into a room and someone say some news that meant I had 6 months left or so. And I just thought, again, as I tell it on stage, I'm crying in bed thinking I won't see my kids grow up. One of them knocks on the door and I shout, go away. which is true. It's just true. And I thought, you know, life's downstairs now. My lovely husband's downstairs. My kids are downstairs now. And what am I doing? And I can think of that moment of that. That was the point. That was in the early December, ready for my surgery, to find out what was going on before my surgery. And, you know, all the scans showed clear, which was wonderful. So then prepared for that surgery. So that was the point where I was like, well, who cares if I have 50 years, if I'm miserable? Mm-hmm. You know, who cares if I can't be miserable? So it was like, get happy,
get the life you want.
Get the life I want. And actually, you could say I did that in comedy, but actually, by the time I'd quit work for comedy, comedy had the same that I'd done everything else in my life. It was like, mock the week, I want mock the week, I want the, you know what I mean? It's just, there's still a trajectory, there's still a real frontal lobe. And I thought, oh, God, this is fun, isn't it? This isn't the circus I signed up for. And actually, even that, you know, you still have your moments, but I think I'm better now at, I can think of a point when I was sort of going through, I'd get up so early, 5 a.m. dog walks and watching the sunrise. And that's all my mate said to me, honestly, Law, you've got to say, because I wasn't telling people on social media, because you're sharing so many inspirational quotes and pictures of sunrises. Everyone thinks you're getting a divorce. behave yourself. So I was really leaning into this positive. So, and now when I'm sort of stressed and I'm sort of, I don't know, I think I just see it as like the warning lights going on a car. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think, oh, I'm miserable. I think rest, pull some things from your diary, go and get some reflexology, go for a long walk.
Does it affect your funniness when you get stressed? Because I would imagine, and I know comedians are not always the people they appear on stage, but I can imagine if real life kind of, you know, machinery and everything and the choreography of life is getting in the way of you, that must be a creative barrier.
Yeah, it really is, in the sense of, you know, you write jokes that are strong enough to kill in any sort of room and everything, but when comedy's magic is when you're connecting with people and you sometimes watch these brilliant, you know, real long in the two comedians come on and go, what's going on in this room? And, you know, and really can draw stuff out and own it and magic. And I had a really nice gig, weekend gig in just this weekend gone, and I said to my friend, I said, I felt very present and very powerful. And that's when I know it's good. So, yeah, it does nobody... This work ethic and these people that are like... There's so many comedians, especially young comedians, that know how to sort of... They're cutting reels and they're pitching this and they're doing that and they've got three different podcasts and they're doing this and... I think... You're not having fun. Like, I don't get it. I don't get it. And I'd rather people go, oh, you must work really hard. And I do. I work really hard in the sense of I'm sort of can be hyper focused on scripts and pitching and things like that and auditions. But generally, I'm like, no, I want to take care of my kids. I haven't done all of this for it to feel like work. I'll do a nice big voiceover or a corporate gig. Thank you very much. And then I'll do what things that I enjoy. And I'm very quick at going, no, I don't like doing that gig. I don't owe anyone anything. I've done a lot of that. I do things that I just really enjoy, work with people I really enjoy, and that's what's nice about it.
You mentioned script writing, and you also, the two female role models or women that you admire in comedy earlier, both have acted in things that they've written, and they've also, you know, Melissa obviously does a lot of acting. Is that something you'd like to do more of then?
Yes, I would. I don't really, I think it's, so before I got in this industry, you know, when you like watching Jonathan Ross or Graham Norton and someone's talking and like an actress is like, oh, we were on location for 6 months in New Zealand. It's really tough. And, you know, you're a public service worker and you're going, oh, tough, you wouldn't know tough. Right, listen, I film my pilot. Acting is the hardest job in the whole wide world. I'm not saying I don't like it, but the thought of being on set for months, that's not something that's, you know,
it's exciting.
I like, no, it's, you know, really early and doing hair and makeup really early. It's hard work. And then not only that, you do another take and you've got to match that energy again. Hats off. It's wonderful. I wouldn't turn it down. Give me a Hollywood film. Thank you. But give me writing all day long. Give me stand up and live all day long. I'm not saying I don't like it. I don't want to not put that in the universe, but it's not something, you know, people love it. You've got to love it because it's such hard work.
And if you love stand up, it's that instant reaction from your audience, which you can't replicate anywhere else, can you, on set. You might have a cameraman that shrugs his shoulders.
Oh,
find
listen.
Something funny, but...
I was in Prue, a BBC thing, and I walked away off doing it. And everyone was like, oh my God, oh my God. I was like, yeah, but no one laughed. They're not allowed to laugh. I was like, oh, you know, I that was really weird to me to sort of speak into an abyss. That was mad. I'm too needy for that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're touring currently, and I was looking the other day to see whether you were coming anywhere near me. Not that I'm lazy. I can travel.
Where are you?
My local theatre is The Swan in Wickham. And we do comedians, but you're not on there, are you?
No.
You're not coming up anyway. But I was then looking kind of at other dates. Actually, even if I'd wanted one, I couldn't get a ticket.
No.
So that must be so lovely when you see sold out across the tour. I always think that with comedians. Like, when you see a poster that says, a few left, you go, no, there's loads.
Yeah, no, there's not. There's no measure. I mean, my tour manager is so amazing, and she's kind of really had more ambition than me, because I was like, oh, I just don't like 5 dates around the corner. And she was like, we sort of set out 20 dates, and then all of a sudden you sell out 100 room in South, and you go, oh, and it's like, we'll do a 600 room. Oh, and then that's nearly sold out. So you go, oh, wow, because you've got no real measure.
No.
It's so funny because you're so in it. And I, you don't really have a measure. There's that bit, I always say that bit in Succession when Logan dies and they go, and the stock market plummets, go, that's how much dad was worth, you know. But I always like, that's for a comedian, their debut tour is, or anyone, their tour is that you go, oh, that's how much people want it. That's the kind of, you go, oh, that's nice. So it's been lovely, yeah.
And that's actually, you know, in the scheme of what we've talked about there, over that, we're basically talking the period of COVID, aren't we? You know, that's how quickly things have turned for you, with a massive health crisis in the middle of all of this, and now selling out on tour.
Yeah.
In terms of your health and how you are, where are you at with that? Are you kind of still having to go for regular checkups and things?
Well, it's really funny with breast cancer. There are cancers that have screening for sort of, if for regular screenings for secretaries and things like that. But in terms of breast cancer, there's no real accurate screening until you have any potential symptoms. But I was considered in remission after my surgeries and everything. It's the chemotherapy, the 6 months chemotherapy and the 3 weeks of radiotherapy. Everything's been adjuvant, as in protective. And I'm on like hormone blockers. It was an estrogen cancer. I'm on hormone blockers, which keep me in sort of menopause, and also I have my ovaries out because I've got the BRCA gene. Obviously,
right.
I had my paternal aunt had cancer, and my sister, so they tested me for the BRCA gene. So I will have another mastectomy, for instance.
Right.
Just an all protective, which I don't mind. So,
are you on hormones that effectively keep you? When you say in menopause,
well, as in, yeah, so as in it blocks all my estrogen,
right?
So I couldn't I am in menopause, and you know, that's funny, that's stark, like, as in you go from
zero to 100 or the other way around,
exactly. Yeah. So that, and that's another thing that I'm aware of. You're aware of how much of your vitality goes, you know, and you work at that sort of thing. So I'm
so
well.
They're not hormones then to give you the boost that people would get from HRT.
No, you can't have HRT.
No, exactly. No. So how will you counter, or how will you deal with those symptoms then going forwards?
Well, I just feel like a very well person. Like I really hate anything that's like, you know, when people talk about, oh, brain fog and baby brain or this sort of thing. I was so determined not to give into chemo brain or anything like that. I'd play like Countdown on my phone, and I'd play word games. I'd really make sure it was like, I always, it's just this determination to not let things affect me. And I just, like I said, I just put a lot of wellness in. I'm very good at resting. I'm really active. I have the real adrenaline of gigging that I have.
So how long will you have to stay on these?
10 years. That's right. 10 years. And then I have so I'm sort of 2 years into, am I? Nearly 2 years into taking those, by the end of this September, sort of October. So I'm quite achy. I've given up gluten. A lot of the drugs that I'm on another drug that affect my digestive system. So I've removed gluten and dairy, and that's really, and I'm on magnesium. Mm-hmm. I'm on a sort of triple magnesium, and there's another supplement that I'm on. So I take a lot of those sorts of things.
And you mentioned wild swimming.
Yeah, I do like that when I get a chance. I like swimming.
Cold swimming.
Cold swimming's lovely. I mean, I just can't lose weight. I mean, I feel I've just resigned to being overweight. I think like the only thing unhealthy about me is my weight, but I just find dieting so boring. I just find it so boring. I think I need to just crack something that works for me, because I just sort of, I think I've got like body dysmorphia in reverse, because I just feel like I look great. And then I see a photo and I think, who's that?
You do look great.
Thanks, Gabby. So generally, yeah, you know, I walk the dog, I'd go for long hour walks. So I'm just sort of, I think I'm just not stressed. I don't let stress into my life. And I do cranial, like I've mentioned, one thing I really stay on, I've started reflexology recently, which is lovely. But a cranial osteopath is just amazing. It's not sort of the manipulative sort of kind of shifting about things heavily like traditional.
Is it the very gentle one from here? Does it work down the back of your head?
Yeah.
I think I did have somebody that I used to know that used to do that. And it is magical.
It's actually magical.
Yeah.
It was recommended to us by a friend. They thought their partner had a stroke, but it wasn't that. But they just hit a wall, I think. And my osteopath describes it as, it's like quantum jazz. You're sort of, I'm not even laughing at that. That's how far gone I am. This is how far down I am in this rabbit hole of wellness. But it's like just being sort of gathered together, and you can feel things reconnecting. And the spiritual healer that I had would do sort of the shin tai stuff. And it's just this sort of, just making sure you're in the world and grounded in all of that.
And you can really feel what you're doing, and you're really present all the time.
Yeah.
Which is very useful as a comedian in terms of material.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Well, it's nice. I always say comedy's a kindness because we don't want a mirror held up to us. But if that mirror is like, aren't we all like this and it's sort of funny and it's skewed, which is sort of, you know, I suppose it's like the funny mirrors in a fairground. That's all right. You go, oh, okay, yeah, I am a bit like that, aren't I? You know, it's rather than go, ooh. And we don't want to be faced with that stuff head on. And some of the stuff I worked with my hypnotherapist, I love it. I've got all these people around me. But I joked on Twitter the other day, I spent all my money on like nutritionists, supplements and takeaways. But he was saying you can't come from a perspective, you can't come from the point of view that other people want to heal. That other people work really hard at their boundaries and their barriers, thank you very much. So you can't come at people head on and say, actually, you need a bit of this and you need a bit of that. But if you come at things and, you know, it's so fun talking about menopause on stage. And what happens is, it's the minute you start talking about menopause, it's never a woman will be there, but her husband's going, yeah, because, you know, that's allowed. You know, they're in this partnership for 20, 30 years. Then all of a sudden, she just goes on the turn.
I said to my husband this morning, because I've been having so many early mornings, I put my gels out. I said, I'll keep forgetting to put my hormones on in the morning. He went, don't fucking do that. No. Like, get them on. He said, if I'd known. I think it is. That kind of, you just a little reminder. That was a little reminder to me that he notices.
Yeah. Justin Morehouse is such a brilliant comedian. He's got the funniest joke, and he says we've got the menopause in our house. He says she's on three patches. She don't know about the third. There you go, love. It's the best menopause joke I've heard, because it is like, and my husband's funny because I was like, I'm mad, isn't I? I'm mad. I'm a little bit mad. He's like, no, you're all right. Like, so yeah, but it's so sad for women that we are. I mean, men have their own struggles, of course, but we're a slave to it, a slave to these hormones. You know, I was watching After Sun last night. Have you watched After Sun?
No.
Gosh. But it's heartbreak. It's brilliant. But it's him on holiday with his 11-year-old daughter, and there's just this innocence about her where she's sort of hanging out with these teenagers slightly. And I just thought, I watched it with such compassion for this 11-year-old because I thought she's just prepubescent. And I thought, it's all just going to go mad for her in a few years. This kid is, I felt so invested because it's so beautifully acted and directed. But I just thought, gosh, I identified with her. And I thought, God, yeah, you're just bundling along, doing headstands. And then the hormones kick in and it's breasts and it's, you know, spots and it's hormones and, you know, libido.
And then it's potentially trouble with working out whether it works or not when you want to have children.
Yeah.
And then all the things that you've kind of taken for granted.
Yeah.
And then this stuff that happens later on that they didn't tell us about at school.
I know.
Before you know it, those periods are going to stop and wait for it.
Oh, yeah, it gets worse. Yeah, and I talk about that. It's like, you know, PMS, it's that all the time, you know. And it is sort of, who would do it? So I think that, I mean, it's almost then you almost want to totally go full circle and regress. You know, actually, I think women should sit on lily pads and be taken care of and worshipped all the time and not allowed out of the house and just be worshipped. And you bring us stuff, thanks. And I think that's actually where we should be at. So I'm like, you know.
How has what you've gone through changed you as a mum, do you think? Because you've had kind of one go with your 21-year-old, right? Do you know what I mean?
Made all the mistakes. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Then you get... But I'm quite envious of that because I have both my kids on the same day. So,
oh, yeah.
So I don't even get a few years to think I'll do that differently.
No.
You know? So how does it differ having... Because your kids are quite... They're under 10, so yeah. They're quite young still.
Well, they suffered. I had to be really selfish in that survival mode. And weirdly, and it's quite perverse, but I forgive myself for it, I kind of kept them at arm's length a little bit when I was going through treatment. There was a little bit of like, you're good. You'll be all right without me. You don't really need me. And I sort of kept them at arm's
almost
length.
Almost pushing them away, ready to be hurt.
Yeah. And which it was is sort of wrong, but I had to do
There's
it.
There's no right or wrong.
No. But as in, if I did die, it would have been much better if I was close with them. But there was this element of like, yeah, you're all right. Yeah, like, and I was sort of running about the countryside with gigs. I just kept working as though I'm still good, as though I sort of could outrun it. And then after we got to the end of that year, they let it be known, actually, I need you. You know, my little boy was definitely all over the place because he didn't even have the language for it. My middle one and the eldest kind of asked questions. But my little one was really acting up, you know, and actually last year was about restoring order in the force. You know, we had to sort of really focus on, oh, they need us. And it was real, no reprimands of his little outbursts and naughtiness. It was, he was all being a big tough guy, a little 4 or 5 year old. And I just pulled a lot of work, and we didn't work for a lot of the summer. We sort of, July and August were just family time. And it was really like, oh, I'm listening loud and clear. And I, what that's got into, because the temptation, especially working for yourself in whatever field, is to just keep, make hay while the sun shines, go. And I won't do it. You know, I'll say no to a gig because I've already got 3 booked in that week. I'm not going to do more than that, you know, because it impacts me. And even the way I've planned the tour, there's...
That's a learning curve, isn't it, being self-employed?
Yeah. I say, I think the first bit of your career is what you say yes to, and the second bit is like healthy no's. Do you know, like you can run about and do things.
You feel quite good though, don't you? When you go, no.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah,
I just turned something down.
Yeah. Anyone? No, you couldn't care less. but it's good to know yourself, and it's good to know what your family needs, and it's just really nice, that sort of... So. In that sense, they are watching. Mm. They do, whether they've got the language for it, whether you've said it explicitly, they are soaking it all up. And actually, I give them a lot more credit than I maybe used to, in the sense of, like, I can say, I really don't want to go to work tonight. I'd rather be at home with you, but I'm doing this and I'll see you in the morning. They really get that and appreciate that, where I wasn't doing that before. It'd be like, you know, I'm explaining things to them and not letting them internalise things. Because they do, kids, don't they? They just think, oh, mum's just running about. And so I'm just making sure that they know that that's...
But they don't know what you're doing when you're out of the house. Have they seen you
on stage?
Have they actually been to a gig?
They've been to... Yeah, they went to... They always come to Latitude Festival.
Right.
And count the swears. And so they're in that and...
What do they think?
They love it. I did House of Games recently, and that's something that we'd watch. And I think they... My middle one, Bonnie, she went... She got quite freaked out by that. She was like, what's your job? You know, actually, what? And why would they have you on there? Are you someone, mummy? Do you know? And I'm nearly babes. But but yeah, so they're interested. They are interested, and they like to keep it all normal. And yeah, they're just, they like it. And then because my husband plays in a couple of bands, and they get so...
Yeah, because he was having his own midlife pivot.
Yeah.
At the same time, which is interesting, because I think, you know, a lot of couples, one of them is more exacerbated than the other one in terms of their midlife changes.
Yes.
But you just decided to throw it in together.
Well, yeah, because...
Roll the dice, as you say.
Roll the dice, because I'm sort of... I think I've always had the sort of go, but not the solid foundation. My husband's such a lovely, safe pair of hands, but I think he would spend his whole life putting other people first and not really. So us getting together was a really good combination for each other. There is that thing when you meet the person, isn't it, that smug marrieds, as they used to be called in Bridget Jones, but that... You, when you find your person, that it's like home. If someone says, you know, what love feels like, it's like home. So I feel like I never thought I could get that with anyone beyond my family who I'm close to. But we're just home for each other. And so when that's safe, you can then go and risk...
Because that home's still going to be there.
Yeah, home's still going to be there. So you can risk stuff in the world. You're not vulnerable anymore. You know, it's very, very powerful, that risk when you're in your teens and 20s, you know, and you've been in the public eye such a long time.
I'm so old, girl.
No, I don't. Well, no, we're put similar age, but in the sense of, I don't know how anyone could have done that. I don't know how you or anyone could have done that in their late teens, early 20s. It's like when you watch people on TOWIE or Love Island and think, God, you're so young.
But
you're
didn't have social media.
Yeah, so yeah, in, of course you didn't. 90s. You could just
so I think
work at your
huge,
craft
yeah,
and build
huge
nicely.
Factor. Make mistakes, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's so important. I always used to joke when I worked at Sky, it probably would have been cheaper to send a VHS out to the amount of people that were watching the show I was doing than actually be broadcasting this live. But it meant that at 6 o'clock, if I made a mistake, at 10 o'clock, I could correct it. And so I was getting those hours and hours of live. Yeah. And it was very, very useful to not be judged by people sat eating their, you know, chip butty, watching the late night sports news.
Yes.
You know, where now they can just send me a message if they want to straight
away.
Oh,
that's horrid, isn't it? I'm off Twitter now, because... There's always that thing like House of Games, people love it. And they feel very personal because it's their programme that they watch while they're having their dinner. And this person comes on, they go, oh, look at her. And it's not personal. They don't know.
I bet you did well on that, did you? I didn't see your
I did
week.
Do well, but
did
I was so competitive.
Did you win the week?
I think I won 3 out of 5. But what
I think I won 3 out of 5.
I won 3 out of 5 because the first two I didn't... It was more just...
I didn't get into it.
No. What it was is the edit doesn't show how quick you have to be on that buzzer.
I was sat next to Tim Key.
Oh, gosh.
And he won the week. think it was 3-2 or 3-1 the other way around.
It's funny, isn't it?
The comedians do brilliantly.
Well, because our brains aren't wired right. But I was next to Dermot Murnaghan, who just knows everything. He knows everything. So, and then Johnny Cochran's a comedian as well. So we were just like this. And I also have, I've got this face that I'm really fine when I'm smiling. But if I'm not smiling, I'm very... And someone's like, oh, she's like a bulldog chewing a wasp. I thought, yeah, I do look like that. But that's because I'm really into this. But, you know, you don't... But exactly, it's unforgiving. I haven't done a lot of telly. I don't know how to be cool yet. Do you know what I mean? I'm just like, I really like House of Games and I watch it every day. And I really want to win.
Being the person you are now, though, that doesn't bother you at all, does it? When somebody comes up with something that's, you know, not...
Oh, no, it always...
Do you think?
Well, if I said something weird now, like, oh, are you sure about what you're wearing? You'd sort of go, hang on a minute. You know, it would. You might, on the drive home, go... What's the problem? See, it will sit with you for a few hours, and then by the next day you go, "All right, I'm over that now." Do you know what I mean?
But yeah, we're old enough and wise enough and been through enough in our lives that we can deal with that.
Yeah.
But I think if you're in your late teens or 20s,
that's what
having
I mean,
to deal
yeah.
with that, it really must be quite. You've got to be quite the tough cookie, haven't you, to deal with stuff like that?
Well, this is it. I've got a whole new perspective coming to this industry. I'm so like. More understanding and admiring of people that have done it. Anyone that's doing it. Like my nephew says, you know, it's like UFC. Even if you lose, you're in the ring. You know, like you got to admire it. And I just admire everyone that's done it. And people that have, like, you know, people have had long careers like you, Gabby. But well, I mean, I feel like that takes a lot. There's people that you just take for granted. You're someone that I just take for granted. You know, Davina McCall, I just take her for granted that... You deliver, deliver, deliver. It's like, no, that takes a lot of work to be that good at what you do. And
who's since you've kind of got into the industry, who's been lovely and kind of like, are comedians good at kind of bringing you along and being caring and sharing and guiding? Have people reached out and helped?
Yeah, I think people generally really are. I mean, I think comedy is one of those things that it doesn't matter how good you can be and how big you are, you could die on your ass tomorrow. Mm. So Lou Sanders has been absolutely amazing. Catherine Ryan's just a champion of everyone. She checks in. Everyone. Judy Love, the first time I've worked with, just so warm. Rosie Jones. Oh, everyone. They just look out for you. Desiree Birch. Kerry Godleman, just wonderful. Susie Ruffle.
We're just
listing them all.
Hall of Fame. Here.
They probably all slagged me off behind my back. I was like, yeah, I've done. No, but they're all just, they all know what it takes and they all see it in you and they go, you're right, and check in and, you know, and it's lovely. Yeah.
Well, I'm so happy that you came on The Midpoint because I think your story is so inspiring in terms of, you know, just the change from teaching to comedy, but what you've gone through as well and being, I loved what you wrote about the language of cancer as well and how difficult it is for people to know what to say and people getting it wrong and people, you know, probably not through any kind of malice, but not saying things that help, which I think anybody who wants to check out. Have you written anything? I read that in an article. Have you actually written a book yet or anything about your time?
Not yet, Gabby. It's coming. I wrote that Observer article off the back of the Radio 4 special that I did, which I don't know what to say. And I got Philippa Perry on for that because I didn't want it to be an attack because the conclusion I come to is no one can say the right thing.
No.
Because you just don't want cancer.
Yeah.
And exactly what we're talking about, being present and connecting, the truth is...
One of the things she said about, sorry, was competitive cancer, you know, people can... Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, my mum had that, but worse, you know.
But it's because we don't know what to say. So we sort of go, oh, we can play word association or things aren't helpful. And really, what does everyone want? Everyone wants to be seen. Mm. Everyone wants to be heard. And actually... we're all carrying our own stuff, aren't we? So actually, when someone says something horrendous, like I've got cancer, you kind of go, soak it in white vinegar and you walk off. Do you know what I mean? Because you think, oh, because actually...
I have to give a solution.
Yeah, we either solve things or we try and show empathy by saying it about someone else. And most people mean well. Mm. And actually, everyone's carrying their own stuff. So actually, I saw a really nice quote the other day that said, I think it was from, is it Ram... Das, is that who I mean? The spiritual guy. But he said something like, all you can do for someone else is work on yourself. Mm. And all they can do for you is work on themselves. Do you know? Like, and that is sort of what we want to get to.
Although I do always think sending biscuits when anybody's got anything, you know, is
send me
helpful.
A biscuit. Yeah. Send me a biscuit.
A box of biscuits. Or my daughter had her wisdom teeth out this week, all four of them.
Oh.
And she, on Tuesday, she had them done on Monday. She said, you haven't got me a care package. I said, I've just mashed some potatoes for you. and I've given you beans for dinner.
Yeah.
There's your care package. But I think that's a child of the TikTok generation.
Oh, like, I know.
What's a care package?
I know.
Oh, you're lucky I took the day off work. What are you talking about?
Do you know who I am? But but it is. We want things, don't we? Something tangible. You just want lifts, don't you? You just want to feel better. Buy me things.
Yeah, buy me things and give me a hug. And listen to me, I think. But no, that your piece was brilliant. And,
oh, thank you. That's so
kind. Yeah, I think there's probably a book in there.
Oh, there's a job.
Thank you so much
for
giving us your time today and sharing your story. And best of luck with everything. And please come to the Wickham Swan.
I will.
Well, Laura was everything I hoped she would be and a lot more. What a woman. And she is currently on the road and taking her show Living My Best Life around the country. You can still get tickets in a few places. Head to laurasmith.com. That's Laura, SMYTH.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would really love it if you could leave me a review. Please share it with your favourite midpointers, or even your first pointers or your late pointers, and hope that they find Laura's story as inspiring as I did. Huge thanks to Spiritland Creative and to you for listening. More musings on midlife coming your way next Wednesday. I'll catch you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
A new year is full of surprises, but one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services. So when postage goes up, your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com is like your own personal post office, wherever you are. You can even take care of orders on the go with the mobile app. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Schedule package pickups, automatically find the cheapest and fastest shipping options, and seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. There's even a supply store where you can stock up on mailing supplies, labels, even printers. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. All you need is a computer or phone and printer. Take a chunk out of your mailing and shipping costs this year with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com code PROGRAM.